So, it's been a busy weekend here at Zen Center. Some of you were here last night. We had a Zen initiation ceremony last night in which 15 people made kind of a formal commitment to the Buddhist path. And it was really beautiful. And some of those folks are here this morning. How many folks were part of that initiation? So quite a few. So you're back for more already. That's great. Yeah, it was really beautiful. I mean, it's great, I think, for a person's practice to do this, to make these vows. And it's great for Zen Center too, to know that so many people are really committed, are really here, really willing to do this thing in a real way, you know. That's really great. So, and I was here kind of late last night, and I was helping with the cleanup, and the kitchen crew said, you're giving the talk tomorrow. You should just go home. You should get your wisdom sleep. And I thought that was really generous. And then they kind of ungenerously added, but it better be a really good talk. So we'll see. We'll see if I earned that little bit of extra sleep. So the title of my talk this morning is 23 Things I Learned at Sonoma Mountain Zen Center. I recently was fortunate enough to get to spend 30 days in a Zen Buddhist monastery in California. And this is part of, this is a requirement for priest training here. If you're a priest here, at some point you need to spend 30 days in a monastic setting. And some people do this on a solitary retreat, and some people go to a monastery. And I wanted to go to a monastery. I like to practice with other people. I think 30 days of a solitary retreat would be it would be really hard. So I probably should have done that, right? But I didn't. And also, I really like a traditional Zen practice. So I wanted to go someplace where they follow the traditional forms. So I asked Tim to make some recommendations, and one place he recommended was Sonoma Mountain, which is in California, a couple hours north of San Francisco. And he knows the head teacher there. The head teacher there is Jakusho Bill Kwong, and Tim and Jakusho practice together back in the 60s at San Francisco Zen Center in Tassajara. So, and they had the same teacher, Suzuki Roshi, so they're pretty well connected. So he made that recommendation. And also I got another recommendation from Rosemary, who was there about 9 years ago, did a 1 week sesshin, and said they know what they're doing there. You know, they've got their ritual down. So that's what I did. I signed up for a 27-day ongo, and I went 3 days early. That made 30 days. So an ongo, for those of you who don't know, it's analogous to our practice period. We have a practice period in spring and fall. And during that practice period, it lasts for 8 weeks, and if you choose to participate in that, you make a commitment to a certain amount of practice, a certain amount of sitting, you know, probably daily. And you read a text, and we get together and we discuss the text, and you do a short retreat or maybe a couple, and you do some work practice. So it's kind of a period of heightened activity, heightened commitment. And this is similar, but it only lasts 1 month, but it's residential. You live there, and you have a schedule the whole time that you follow, and there are a lot of activities. I told people I'm going to a monastery for 30 days, and people said, oh, that sounds relaxing. No, it is not relaxing. It is many things, but it is not relaxing. Because they push you. They push you. You know, it's kind of, you kind of come up against your edge when you do something like this. And that's the idea. And on the edge is where you learn things. So there's this busy schedule. Once a week, you get a day off. Three of the weeks were about 4 hours a day of meditation, plus work practice, plus some other things. The third week was a sesshin, where you sit more. You sit about 7 hours a day. So that was kind of heightened. But it was nice. You had 2 weeks to prepare for that. So this has kind of been a fun talk to prepare. It's kind of basically what I did on my summer vacation. I wanted to talk about it because people ask me, how was it? And actually, that's kind of a difficult question, and I've come up with a one-word answer, which is great. But it was great, that's true. But there's more to it than that. I mean, 30 days in a monastery seems infinite. It's like time slows down. It really does. I would get up at 4:05 a.m. and start with 108 prostrations at 4:45 a.m. And then you have a sitting, and then walking meditation, then another sitting, then a lengthy service, chanting service, and then some qigong exercises, and then you go over to the sangha house for a formal or yogi meal, and breakfast is over. It's 8:45, and you feel like you've put in a full day, and you've still got 13 hours to go. And by the time you get to bed at 9:15 that night, those prostrations you were doing, it feels like about 2 weeks ago. It seems to last forever. Not in the sense of, oh my God, when are they going to ring the bell? This is forever. But in the sense of, if your mind gets a little quiet and you're really paying attention to what's going on, it's like you're fully living your life and you're really there, So a lot happened during the course of the day. So I'm glad I get this opportunity to kind of elaborate on this a little bit. So 23 things. Number one. First thing. These folks at Sonoma have a really good sense of Zen theater. You know what I mean by Zen theater? It's kind of some of the sort of pageantry, the ritual that we have. We had some of it last night, and it was really beautiful. I went to Sonoma I was basically there during the month of August. I think I arrived on July 28th. And I flew in early in the morning and got on a little shuttle bus and went over the Golden Gate Bridge and into Northern California. And someone picked me up in a little town and drove me about 20 miles up this mountain through a redwood grove. And I get there, and it's an amazingly beautiful place. And I have lunch, and everyone's really nice. And I spend the day settling into my cabin. They gave me a cabin. Can you believe it? I've spent so much time down in Hokkaido in a tent, sleeping on the ground, And so this seemed really luxurious. And then in the evening, I joined them for dinner. And it happened that they were having a hungry ghost ceremony that night, which is a pretty elaborate ceremony. And a hungry ghost, for those of you who don't know, this is kind of, you might say, Buddhist mythology. There are six realms where various types of creatures live, and one of those creatures is a hungry ghost. And a hungry ghost is a creature who has an enormous belly, so they're always hungry and thirsty, but they have a tiny mouth. Their mouth is only as big as the eye of a needle, so they are always frustrated. And some people think of these beings in the six realms, they think of these six realms as places where we can be reborn after we die. And that's one way to think of it. I think maybe a more useful way to think of it is that this is a psychological state that we all slip into now and then. Sometimes we're hungry ghosts. Sometimes we have this sort of addictive feeling about life. We just want more. We want more of something. It could be information. It could be stimulus, whatever. But we get really hungry. So this ceremony, which is a chanting service that lasted a long time, is sort of to call these hungry ghosts and say, it's okay, we're here with you, relax, it's okay. Your great hunger can be taken care of for a while. So you kind of call them in. Or you could think of this as, addressing the hungry ghost within ourselves, kind of taking care of this suffering being within, or this suffering being of the people around us. So the chanting was great, and they have, outside of the Zendo in the hall, they have this really big drum, and it stands about as high as I do, maybe a little higher, and it's about, maybe 20 inches across, and it's this long drum, and somebody gets two sticks, and they hit it, ba 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 ba, like this. And they did that during the ceremony, and they're really good, and it just sounded really good. and it vibrates the floor. You're sitting in the Zendo and it vibrates the floor. And like, it was like exciting. Like, I was so excited by the sound of this drum. It's like, whoa, what's going on here? You know? And it's designed to bring you to the moment, and it really did this. And they do this at other times too. During Sesshin, you have Oryoki in the Zendo. I'll explain Oryoki later. You have Oryoki in the Zendo, not in the Sangha house. And when they bring in an offering to the altar, they hit this same drum. And every time, I just kind of felt this same excitement. It really brought me back to the moment, which is the idea. And I finally figured out, you know what I think it is? I think it kind of imitates the sound and the feeling of the human heart within your chest when you're really excited and it's just really beating. I think that's why it had that effect. And then at the end, there's all this chanting. It kind of builds to a crescendo. And at the end, they really want to call out the hungry ghosts, right? So they bring out this gong, and they hit this gong really fast and really hard. Bang, 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 bang. And at the same time, this guy gets out this conch shell and blows on this conch shell. Have you ever heard one? I'd never seen one before, you know, only on TV or in movies. So you got this banging, you got this conch shell. It's like hungry ghosts. Hello, hello, we're here for you. And I love that because that's Zen. I mean, you know, Zen, it's about this right here, nothing else. So that was pretty cool. So that was my first night. And I thought, I'm in the right place. I like this. So the next morning, I come to the sitting, and I'm doing the first sitting, and it's really foggy, and I'm sitting in the Zendo, and it seems to be raining, and I think they have really strange rain here in California because it's sporadic. It's like you hear it on the roof. There's this corrugated roof on the Zendo, and you hear like bump, 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 bump. And how can rain be like that? And I thought about it a lot because I've got my city mind, right? It wants to figure everything out. And it's in a new place. I haven't been to California once, and there are just all these mysteries, you know. So what's going on here? And I figured it out after 2 or 3 days, what was going on. Well, and I asked some people later on. What that is, the Zendo is built in a little redwood grove. These redwoods, you know, huge, huge redwoods towering over the Zendo. They're really beautiful. And what happens is they collect fog. I didn't know about this at all, but the reason redwoods can survive there on the coast, even though they have an incredibly dry season, is that they take in moisture directly from the fog. Like 40% of their moisture comes directly from the fog. So they collect it on their needles. So it collects on their needles, and it also drops off of them. So that's what was going on there. That's not particularly significant. That's a little setting. Number three, I found, and I was pleased about this, I can still do 108 prostrations. And I was a little surprised. I didn't know I could. So a prostration, for those of you who don't know, is something that we do sometimes where we stand and we face the altar and we put our hands like this and we make a little bow and then we drop down to our knees and then we drop down further all the way down and touch our forehead on the floor and raise our hands like this. And then we pop back up and then we do it again. Usually we do three. And and these prostrations, you know, it looks a little bit like sort of being worshipful, but it's really not that. It's a ritual designed to do several different things. You know, it's not bowing down to a god because we don't have a god in Buddhism. It brings you back to the moment. It brings you back to the moment because it's a little complicated. It's a little hard. I mean, when you get to about 98, you are really in the moment. And it also expresses giving, you know. It expresses giving because this practice is about giving up ego, about giving up your own view, your own self-centered view, and kind of tapping into a larger view about, you know, what's going on here with the universe. And if I can tap into what's going on with the universe instead of seeing it from my own little point of view, I am more likely to act in accordance with how the universe is. I'm more likely to be skillful. I'm more likely to be kind. This is a very giving thing. So when we do this, we're expressing giving, and we're reminding ourselves of giving. And the last, this is a Korean thing. This is borrowed from Korean Buddhism. And the last time I did 108 prostrations was in Ann Arbor when I first started practicing formally almost 20 years ago. And I remember doing 108 cold without any, you know, building up to it, and being really stiff for about 3 days, and, you know, kind of having a hard time walking. So I thought, I'm not going to do 108 right away. I started with about 54, and that went okay. And it took me about 10 days to work up to 108, and then I was able to do it. And this is like practice generally. You know, in the beginning, it's kind of sheer survival. Your mind is going. You know, your mind is going, can I do this? How should I do this? This is so strange. Should I switch now to maybe doing every other one? Should I go to every other three? And I count, because my mind loves to quantify, you know. It's like, ooh, statistics. You know, I love these. But the day finally came when I'm not counting, and I'm not thinking, and I'm not planning. I'm just doing the prostrations, and I can pay attention, and I can see what it feels like, and my motions become more smooth, and I kind of observe the mat as I go down, and just what it feels like, and just kind of let go, you know, just kind of let go and not be thinking about this. So just doing the activity, which is a theme I'm going to come back to some more. Number four, don't wear your koromo when you're doing prostrations. A koromo is a really sort of large, heavy garment that priests wear under their outer robe. And the first day I showed up to prostrations, I was wearing that because I didn't know any better. And everybody else had like sweatpants and a t-shirt or something like that. So I felt kind of out of place. Number five, it's really awkward to do prostrations in a koromo. Number six, if you're serving an oryoki meal. Now, oryoki, for those of you who don't know, is there anyone who's here for the very first time today who hasn't been to Zen Center before? A bunch of people. That's great. That's great. Is there anyone here who has been to the intro, but this is their first time down in the Zendo? Not today. Not today. Oh, one person. Oh, I see. I see. Well, that's okay. Great. Glad you're here. So where was I? Oh, yeah. So oryoki, just a very brief explanation of what oryoki is. That's a formal way of eating that we have. And it's like the prostrations. It's not a sacred thing. It's something that helps us to be really mindful. So each participant has some bowls wrapped in a cloth and some utensils. And there's this way that you unwrap the bowls in kind of a precise way, and then people come and they serve you, and there's some bowing and all of this stuff. And it's really very beautiful. So if you're serving an oryoki meal in the Sangha house and you drop a big piece of lettuce on the Shuso's robe at the head table where all the transmitted priests are, just don't make a big deal out of it. She won't. Pick it up, put it in your own bowl, move on. So, number seven, this is from Jakusho. A good monk always brings his bowls, he said. And I felt kind of bad because I didn't bring my bowls. So monks, take note. Always bring your bowls. Number eight, this isn't really something I learned, but something I was reminded of. And that's what it's like to be a novice. I felt like a real novice out there. You know, here I feel I kind of know what's going on. I've been here a while. And out there, the spirit of what they do is just, it's exactly the same. And it's the same experience. It really is. And the forms are generally the same, but it seems like every detail is different. Every little thing they do is different. All the translations are different. One small example, when you go to the Sangha house for oryoki, you wear a rakusu over your koromo. You priests will know what I'm talking about. And that just felt really strange. A lot of things felt strange. And the first morning, I was sitting in the Zendo the very first morning, and I had a seiza bench, a little bench you can sit on, because I have a really hard time sitting for 40 minutes without sitting in seiza because my legs just go dead asleep. So I was sitting on a seiza bench and doing it the way I was taught, which is to hang your feet off the back of your zabuton a little bit. And But what I didn't realize is where I was sitting was exactly where the guiding teacher, Jakusho, would need to walk in order to do his service. So he comes in, and he's been gone for 30 days visiting his Polish Sangha, and this is his first day back in the Zendo. And what does he see as he begins to do his service? He sees these 2 feet right there. And you want to impress the head teacher, right? And the very first thing he said to me was, please try to get up on the mat. You're off the mat. And I was kind of mortified. And this was really a good lesson, I think, because it kind of reminds me of what it's like to be a novice here and what it felt like for me when I was here for the very first time. And I know that I think that can be a little difficult because someone comes in and they see we have these forms, and we don't have so many, and they're not that complicated, but we do some little bows. It kind of depends on when you come. Sometimes we do more than at other times. And you want to respect them, and you want to do well. And probably you don't really know what our attitude is toward that. You know, so you're kind of afraid of making a mistake. Like, am I violating some sacred rule? Is this going to, you know, really bring the wrath of the Zen gods or something? I mean, you don't know, right? You don't know. So I want to say a couple of things about being new. And one is that these are not sacred rules. And in fact, now and then we should, and we do deliberately violate them, just to point that out. They're not sacred rules. These are things that really help us to be mindful, that really help us to be here in the moment. Because there's something about combining these activities with all of the meditation that really helps us to kind of let go of our thinking mind. So people know you're new. They know you may not know exactly what to do, and they're okay with it, so you can relax. Another thing about that is you can recognize that this wanting to do well and being really concerned about getting everything right is really all ego. I mean, it may not seem like ego because you're thinking, well, I'm trying to do well. I'm not trying to do something for myself. But in a way, you are, because you're wanting to be in control. And you're not wanting to be in that really awkward place, you know, the same way I was out there. I mean, I'm a priest. I'm supposed to know what I'm doing, right? And I keep making these mistakes. But if you can let go of that sort of wanting to be in control, that's an act of generosity. That's saying, I'm willing to go on this little adventure, you know. I'm willing to accept a little awkwardness at first. I'm going to relax. The same way I would want you to relax if you came into my home, right? I'm just going to relax. I'm going to do my best. I'll probably make a mistake, and I'm going to let it go. And it helps to have, you know, maybe a little courage is needed here. You know, Zen is about throwing yourself into the great unknown. And you don't want to deprive yourself of what we have here out of a little fear. And sometimes people go up to the introduction and they're there and they do all four and never really make the transition to coming down here because they're worried about these things. Please don't worry about these things. Please just relax. And please value that place of not knowing. Of not knowing, because that is a really fertile place, a really fertile place for spiritual practice. If you think you know, you're done for. You're done for. That's why Zen is always kind of shaking things up. So, but having said that, I think that we experienced people here at Zen Center need to do a really good job of welcoming new people. You know, if you're here for the morning sitting or the evening sitting and someone is next to you and they kind of, you know, it's obvious that they're new, you know, help them find a place in the chant book, you know. Maybe they're standing right here and they're the first, they're supposed to be the first one to walk out, but they don't know how to do that. Go out ahead of them. Have them follow. You know, don't worry about breaking the rules yourself. It's more important to welcome people than it is to follow these rules precisely. So, number 9, you're not a novice forever. This is good news. And I discovered this kind of in work practice. They called me about work before I went out, and they wanted to know, you know, what kind of work do you like to do? Do you have any physical limitations and things like that? Now, a really good monk would have said, oh, I'll do whatever's needed. You know, I'll be happy to clean the bathrooms. Do you have bathrooms to clean? But I didn't. I was not a good monk. I said, I like to work hard, and I like to work outside. And the person I was talking to said, well, our work leader was thinking about assigning you to weed whacking. And I'm like, that sounds great. Because I really enjoy that kind of thing. And people out there didn't believe me because they'd see me, I'd be all just dirty from head to foot, and I'd be covered with sweat, and they'd think, oh, poor Ted, he's making such a sacrifice for all the rest of us, you know. But I loved it. I loved that kind of work. I needed to clear a couple of really big fields of weeds, and I must have spent 30 or 40 hours weed whacking. And using this sort of this gasoline-powered weed whacker that you strap on yourself with a strap, and there's this gasoline engine back here, you know, and at the end there are these 8 little strings of nylon or something that go around really fast, and that cuts the weeds, right? So you get the thing in balance, and you just kind of move forward, and you cut the weeds. And it was really awkward at first. The engine was really temperamental, and it took me a long time to learn how to do that. And the strap, it was hard to adjust it. These things are always made for bigger people, you know, and it took me a long time to get adjusted. I tried it on each shoulder. I finally found out which one would work the best. And I didn't know that if you try to cut one of the green plants, it's going to be a little harder, and you gotta hold back a little bit. You have to do it gradually. I didn't know that if you break a string, it starts sounding a little bit different, so you can stop and replace the string. You don't have to wait till you're down to one string, and it's really not cutting very well. But I kept at it, and after several days, something just clicked. Something just clicked, and all of a sudden, it was just like that. I started moving differently with this thing, and moving differently, and a little faster, but with no stress and no anxiety and no thinking about it. It was like suddenly I was on this higher plane of weed whacking. And you can probably guess what happened then. I said to myself, I'm on a higher plane of weed whacking. And then, oh, boom, back on the lower plane of weed whacking. So back to square one. But I got there again. It clicked that way with my partner Max too. We were working on this together, and we didn't really talk because Tim really stresses silence on things like this. So I didn't really talk to people very much. But after several days of working together, something just clicked, and we were a team, and we could anticipate each other's needs and things like that. So that's an example from work practice. But it was really like that with all the forms of practice. You know, you get used to it, and at first it's your mind working, and you don't know what's going on, but you keep at it, and you get to that point where you're just doing it. You're just doing it. So, number 10, small thing but very important, I discovered about 10 days in, if you go to the Sangha house about 4:35, you can get a cup of coffee before you do your 108 prostrations. This, I thought, was significant. Number 11, it takes a long time to get quiet coming from the busy world. Even if you're a priest and even if you've been doing this for a long time. Before I left, there was quite a, you know, crescendo of activity. There were a lot of things to arrange. And my mind was really very busy. And usually if I go on a one-week retreat here in this building or at Hokyoji, it seems to take about 3 days, you know, for things to really quiet down nicely. And that's why retreats, I think, are so important. If you sit for a half hour, you may find quite a bit of quiet, which is really great. If you commit yourself to a daily sitting practice, maybe it's only 10 minutes a day, you may find that it really makes a difference. It may actually change your life. But a retreat where you do this kind of thing day after day is really a whole other thing. And so what I have to say about that is please do one. Please do a retreat if you haven't. Start with something small. Start with a half-day retreat or maybe a one-day retreat. Make sure you're ready. Make sure you can do that much sitting. Do some extra sitting ahead of time to work up to it. And then maybe work up to a longer one. Every year in December, we do a Rohatsu retreat, and that's 7 days. Make the time if you can. One thing I thought to myself in Sonoma is, I should have done this years ago, you know. Make time. Do it now. If you don't do it now, when will you do it? Number 12, this is something that I kind of knew intellectually, but I now feel like I kind of feel in my bones. And that is how this Zen Center, is connected to a large network of centers and other teachers, and how wonderful this is. I'm a monk who doesn't get out very much. I usually stay here. I practice here. Because part of that is I just don't have the time to go to other centers. I only have so many days per year when I can do retreats, and I like to do them here with my own sangha. And also, I would rather practice with my own teacher than some other teacher. You know, I don't care how famous or whatever that teacher might be. I like being with my own teacher. So some people are able to go to other centers, and this is obvious to them. They see the connection. Or many of you have practiced in other places, I'm sure, and you see that connection. But it was, in a way, kind of new to me. And the first night during that Hungry Ghost ceremony, they did a dedication where the Doan kind of dedicates the merit of what we're doing to many different beings, and starting with the Buddhas and ancestors. And then the Doan says, to Dainen Katagiri, founder of the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center. And, oh, man, it's like a tear came to my eyes. Like, really? Wow, they're saying this. And I thought, that's not because I'm here, is it? And no, it wasn't. It wasn't. I'm not that important. They do this all the time. I mean, they've been doing this, I think, for years and years. They do this dedication to Katagiri, the founder of this center. Jakusho and Shinko, his wife, they remember Katagiri very well. I mean, he's one of their major teachers. And they were here years ago to visit him when their kids were little, and Katagiri's kids were little. And Niose, Jakusho's son, told me how Katagiri had taken them on a camping trip. And that was a pretty good story. And everyone remembers Tomoe, Katagiri's wife, who helped everyone sew their rakasus, which they did as part of their initiation. And just think of her with such respect as a sewing teacher. And they know about us. You know, they know that Minnesota is a very significant place in American Zen. And they were impressed by the number of priests we have here. I told people we have 10 priests here at Zen Center. And they thought, wow, that's really something. So that was pretty sweet. I just felt really, really good about that. Number 13, but people in Sonoma, people at Tassajara, these places you can read about in books, they're still just like us, you know. You might be a little intimidated or something to go to these places, but they're just like us. They're doing this. Sometimes they get it right, sometimes they don't, you know. Doesn't matter. They're doing it. So okay, I think I'm going to have to skip 14 and 15 here. Number 16, Jakusho, I thought, gave me the best advice or yogi I've ever gotten. He said, I'm not interested in anyone's mistakes. Or yogi is a ritual. It's magic. Just find the magic in it. You know, each little cloth, it has a life of its own. And he was talking during one of his Dharma talks about how he's been doing Oryoki for 50 years, and that very morning, I think, he said, really for the first time, I felt what it was really like to squeeze that napkin in my hand at the end when I'm wrapping things up. And I think that's really true. Oryoki, you may do the ritual, you think you know it, you think, okay, that's enough. I probably did 60 or 70 Oryoki meals out there, and I saw what he was talking about. There is new stuff to discover all the time. Not in the sense of, you know, getting it right and getting the rules right, but in the sense of being really intimate with what is in front of you and feeling something for the very first time and really being there. And in one Oryoki meal, there are 1,000 opportunities for really being there. And we miss, you know, how many do we miss? 980 of them. So there is more to do there. And I learned a lot of details, and I'm still not great at Oryoki even after all that, but I learned a lot of details. There's this part where you have a utensil holder and you kind of put it against yourself and you open it up and you take the things out. You know that part? Jakusho said you're supposed to jab yourself when you do that to wake yourself up. And so I tried that and I jabbed myself and I felt like nothing because I'm wearing 4 layers of clothing. I got my robes, right? So next time I do it, and I do it a lot harder, and my setsu like flips out onto the floor. So I discovered something new about Oryoki. So a little more about ritual, number 17. If I can speak a little bit about my preferences here, my small mind preferences, I'll tell you, I'm good on Oryoki till Rohatsu. I've had enough Oryoki for a while. That's okay. And I've had enough of changing in and out of my robes, because I had to change clothes like, I don't know, maybe 10 times a day. Because you have 3 services where you wear your robes, you have work practice, you have other things going on. So I'm okay on that till Rohatsu also. But I never got enough chanting. I could always do one more chant. We would do 4 lengthy chants in the morning, one at the lunch service and one at the dinner service. And they encourage chanting with a lot of energy, which is really great. And it's possible to sit kind of hunched and your chanting comes just from the back of your throat, you know, kind of like that's basically, I think, where my voice is coming from now. But you can also sit really straight. I mean really straight. And you get this vibration going. You know, you're chanting from way down in your belly, way down in your hara region. Avalokiteshvara. You get this vibration going. And if you have a zendo full of people doing that, really chanting from that deep place and also listening carefully. You know, you chant with your ears. You listen to everyone else and you fill in the gaps and you fit in with everyone else. You don't sort of just go off on your own and kind of, you know, chant loudly on your own. If you can do all of that stuff, sometimes it seems like you're just kind of tapping into the hum of the universe, you know, and there are no individuals present. There's just this thing, this hum, which is no hum, which is really not there at all. It's a little bit like Phil Lesh, the bass player for the Grateful Dead. I think he once said something like, oh, we don't make the music. We find the music that's already there. And I think chanting is like that. So it doesn't matter what language the chant is in. It doesn't matter if you understand the words. It doesn't matter if you get it right. What matters is that you just do it with your whole heart and mind. This is designed to help us, but you got to put your whole heart and mind into it. You really got to be there with the chant. Every time we chant, it's a great opportunity. Don't waste that opportunity. Number 18, expectations can do you in. I learned this for the 1,000th time. It seems... I know that going to a retreat with expectations is not helpful, but it's hard not to do. It's hard not to do. This is Jakusho's book, No Beginning, No End. And on the cover is an Enso. And I think you can all see this. It's a circle. You just need to see that it's kind of a nice, neat circle. An Enso, it's a traditional sort of art we have in Zen. There's a little tiny one on the back of your zafu, most likely. It's kind of a symbol of the absolute. And it's said that you can kind of see how deep someone's practice is by how they make the circle. So this is a nice, round, beautiful one on the cover of the book. And I was in their bookstore, and I found another Enso on this card. I know it's a little hard to see, but all you need to see is that the circle is not quite round. Can you see that? There's kind of a little bulge there. It's not quite round. And I thought, this is a pretty nice card. It says, "Only don't know," which is a really wonderful phrase that I repeat to myself a lot. Only don't know. Don't be certain. Keep that beginner's mind. If you think you know what's coming next, you're going to miss it. You have to open yourself up. So I like that. But so I think I'd like to buy this card. I'll give it to someone sometime. But what's with this Enso? It's got this little bulge here. You know, I want a nice round Enso like this one. Why would he do that? Because he's a really, Bill Kwong, he's a really great calligrapher. Why would he do that? And, well, I think he did that precisely because of my reaction, right? Right? Because we have these expectations. This is only don't know. Like, you know, hello, you know, you're expecting a round Enso. You're not going to get that. You're getting this crooked Enso. So I kind of went to Sonoma with this idea of this perfect Enso, and I kind of found this one with the little bulge in it. And that's about expectations, you know. It is what it is. But I went out there thinking, you know, kind of this is my big chance. I don't want to waste it. I've got 30 days here. I'm not going to get 30 days again for a long time. And I don't want to waste it. I don't want to disappoint my teacher. And something will happen, you know. I expected something to happen. And on retreat, sometimes, you know, a person's practice will deepen. And this can happen in a couple of different ways. Sometimes it can happen rather suddenly. You can have a sudden experience. Sometimes it can happen very gradually. And the example that we often hear about that is you're wearing your robes and you take a walk in the fog. And you start out, you're dry, and it's at the end, you're completely wet. And you can't say when it is you got wet. It just happened very gradually. So there are those two different approaches. And when I go on retreats, the sort of things I really remember have been of the sudden variety. And I thought that would happen this time. I'm going to be gone for 30 days, right? So something's going to happen, and it's going to be big, I think. And there were some sudden things, but they were pretty small. And this thing I was looking for did not come. Did not come. So not so much drama. And it seemed at times that nothing was happening. And the point came where, you know, I'd been coming up with these strategies. This is my ego talking to my ego, right? Saying, "Ted, you know, chant gate gate continuously. It'll bring you back to the moment." And I did that, and I would try something else like that. But eventually, you know, I kind of gave up and surrendered to the schedule. And the person, the Shuso who was leading the retreat, talked about that at just the most opportune time, you know. Surrendering to the schedule, giving up to the angle. And that's where you just kind of drop your agenda of what you want to accomplish here, and you just do the stuff. And it tends to happen in long retreats. And it's sort of a crucial thing. So I did that. And so there's this gradual deepening, you know. And I see a thought arise, and it just goes nowhere, you know. Thought comes up, and it just kind of does not stick around. When you get really quiet, that's how it is. Sometimes a thought comes up, and you follow it a bit, and then it dies. Sometimes you're tired, and you indulge the thought quite a lot. But you see it's empty. You know, these thoughts are not you. These are thoughts you kind of watch. And Jakusho talked about how your relationship to thoughts can be like this. Like a serene old man watching children playing on the playground. Your thoughts, they're like play. Your thoughts are play. Your thoughts are not you. But your thoughts are not extinguished either. They're there. Another thing he talked about was, he quoted someone talking about thoughts being an ornament to clear-seeing mind. You know, this is nice because sometimes we think we need to, we have this burden of thought, right? We're dragging this thing around. This thought attaches to everything. We're in this beautiful, vivid world and we've got these thoughts and we're dragging them around like we're some draft animal pulling a bunch of carts or something, and it gets really tiresome. And we think we've got to extinguish them, you know. But we don't have to extinguish them, you know. You just see that the thoughts are not you. And the thoughts are like play. The thoughts are like an ornament. It's like peaceful coexistence, right? This is not the enemy. You can't have an enemy in Zen. You can't have another. You can't push something away. You can't get rid of something. It's just what's here. What's here? Thoughts are part of that. And this is sustainable, I think. It's something... I thought of that phrase from, I think it's in the Fukan Zazengi, it can be summoned at will. Although that's a strange phrase, summoned at will. If you say it can be summoned at will, then you're calling it. That's misleading. Calling it is like saying there is this special state that I can call upon. Like there's this thing. Like it's this real thing. Like there's this hum in the universe. There's this thing out there I can tap into. And it isn't that at all. Because if you're looking for that, if you have an idea of what it is and you're trying to tap into it, you're not going to find it. You know, you have to open. Only don't know. So it's not that. It's not ego talking to ego and saying, we're going to find this thing. It's ego stepping aside. And even that is not accurate, because ego stepping aside, that's something ego does. It's not about ego at all. It's just this thing, you know, the other thing. It's being quiet enough that the other thing comes up, and there is this other thing, you know, which sees the ego doing all this stuff. And I thought I learned a lot about this from the residents out there. They have a residential program. There were about, I think there are 11 people living there at the monastery. And some of these are residents who commit to living there for at least a year. And some have been there for 5 or 6 years. And they just do what they're doing, you know, without drama and without comment, without thinking, you know, without ego talking to ego. It's just doing it. Just doing the next thing. Just opening. Just opening. And this is practicing as a Buddha, not to be a Buddha. Not to be a Buddha. And sometimes it's no big deal. You know, it's no big deal. It's opening. It's opening this moment, you know, without that talking. Without that internal monologue. It's just what here? What's here? And sometimes what's here can be unpleasant. Sometimes what's here can be really boring. Sometimes it can be really vivid. Sometimes it can really be joyful. But what it never is the thing you were looking for. So I have a quote from Shohaku Okamura, which is, I think, on your program. Do you have other programs this morning? Good. He said, this is from Realizing Genjo Koan, he talks about Dogen's burning question. If all things have Buddha nature, why did Buddhas and ancestors have to arouse Bodhi mind and practice? We're all Buddha already, so why do we have to practice? Why can't we just do anything? Dogen's answer to this question was just practice. Not because we want to escape from samsara, not because we want to reach nirvana, but just practice right now, right here, without any agenda. With this kind of practice, nirvana is already here. Of course, when we practice in this way, samsara is here too. So within this practice, at this moment, both nirvana and samsara are present. So I think I learned something about the everydayness of this. And let's see. I'm up to 19. Number 19, you can't make rules about this, about how to do this. You can't make rules. I was in the bookstore. They have a little bookstore, and Jakusho was there with another Angle participant. And she said she was buying a Zen book, and she said to Jakusho, "I'm only reading Zen now. I'll never stray again." And he said, "You just did." So once you think you know something, once you've made a rule, you're finished. You're finished. So number 20, I found an animal I identified with, and that was the banana slug. Has anyone ever seen a banana slug? Yeah, yeah. So there, I saw this slug. It's about 4 or 5 inches long, bright yellow, has spots. I didn't look it up, but it has to be a banana slug. It looked just like a banana, you know. And it's moving across the path down in the shadow of the tool shed. Almost imperceptibly. You could barely see it move, you know. And expectations, again, I went to Sonoma. You know, if I had asked myself before I go to Sonoma, okay, what kind of animal am I going to identify with here? You know, I might think, you know, some really cool animal, some really active animal. You know, something like Manjushri's lion here. But I got there and the banana slug, because it moves really, really slowly. And also it's very open, kind of open and vulnerable. You wonder how they survive as a species, because to any predator they must look like this big marshmallow. It's a really tasty thing. And they have no defenses and they can't move.
It's the slime that protects them.
Really?
No.
Because?
They're slimy.
No one wants to eat a slimy creature? Really? Oh, okay. Okay, cool. Okay. So that's my spirit animal. So this is a lengthy talk, but 21 I'm skipping. 22, residential and non-residential centers are really different. Residential centers are wonderful. If you have a number of people living there on site every day and they have a lot of work practice and they're very quiet, it's amazing what you can do. You know, kind of everything looks great physically. It's a beautiful place, just an incredible place. And everything has a place and there are written instructions for everything. And it is so good to know that there are places like this where, I mean, all of this organized stuff I'm talking about is just a reflection of how quiet people can get. And it's so good to know we can go to these places. And they have stuff we don't have here, kind of like Hokioji has things we don't have here. But here at our non-residential center, which is basically non-residential, I think there's much more community involvement. I mean, we have a really big membership, and we're all, you know, those of us who have been here a while, are really a vital part of this place. And I feel that our Tim and our other priests are really sort of modeling being in the very active world and having a very vital practice at the same time. And I think this is really valuable and wonderful. I firmly believe you can have a deep practice in the midst of a busy world. And so both kinds of centers are really important and really good. And number 23, I would just say that here in our non-residential urban center, I think we're learning to navigate the world with a very quiet mind and a very open heart, and we're doing this together, and I think it's really... wonderful, and it's so good to be back, and I really missed all of you, and I'm so glad I'm here. This is the place to be. This is the place to be. So that's my story on Sonoma. Thanks for listening. I have time for about maybe one question. It was a long talk this morning. Thanks for indulging me. We should have put a stretch break in there.